emotionality, emotional life, subjectivity are ruled by certain laws and principles, and many of them go back to narcissism. And the tools with which we can undo that narcissism and the fantasies of intersubjectivity that we live by every day were given to us by psychoanalysis. Emotional life is not just affect. It's not just contagion. It's not just virality. It's not out of control and beyond our ken. Like, there are laws and rules by which emotional life governs our intersubjective lives. One of them being, like, we're all little narcissists and we want to be pure. We want to be loved. We want to be recognized. We want to belong. That overrides a lot of rationality, even in the most rational spaces. And you can see how certain decisions are made. You and I have been, you know, talking about this for a long time, within these very, very intense protest culture moments, that wrong decisions are made because there's a kind of group psychological fetish for certain ideas like anarchy or horizontality or spontaneity. And those ideals actually become like leader ideas. And all the cool kids are like, I want to be spontaneous, so organization is bad. And there's a high level of emotionality that goes into that, because somehow we think this leading idea, this leader, is going to sanctify us with this kind of love that we wanted from the father, that we wanted from the leader of any group. And that sanctification, like, I'm going to be loved by everyone if I'm just the most anarchist person in this room, that can actually be analyzed. That can actually be talked about.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Ohili in São Paulo, Brazil. And today I'm here with our regular contributor, Catherine Liu, who's calling in from Orange County, California. How's it going?
Good. Thanks.
Are you exercising your subjectivity?
I always do.
That's good. No, I just wanted to check. Actually, I asked that to everybody as soon as they come on the podcast, just to start off on that basis. For listeners, this is part of our series on the politics of feelings, on the emotional turn, that series called Emotion Sickness. And just to fill you in on what you may have missed up till this point, we have had Nina Power on the podcast talking about anger and repression, talking about evil as well, which isn't an emotion, but we tried to tease out what the relationship between those things might be. Ashley Frawley was also on the podcast talking about the politics of happiness, the turn towards resilience, the role that vulnerability and questions of mental health play in contemporary culture and politics. And we also talked about the affect of the post-populist decade that we're moving into, the withdrawal from hyperpolitics. We talked in the context of an essay that I've written for the forthcoming issue of Damage magazine, which you can check out as soon as that comes out, which I think is in the coming weeks. So that's a lot of talk about affect, a lot of talk about the emotional turn, I think, which maybe has followed the what is known as the cultural turn, which I think people might be more familiar with. The emotional turn is maybe a term that hasn't been that widely discussed. But today we're going to talk with Catherine. We're going to have a conversation about melodrama and the decline of the bourgeois subject. So I'm going to ask you this. I told you this, but I'm going to ask you this stupid question at the start, which is, what is the bourgeois subject and why is it a good thing and why have we lost it?
Why is it a good thing? Well, politically, it's really the ground of Republican small r politics, and it really begins to be an ideal image of sovereignty, self-possession, reason when you have the bourgeois enlightenment of the 18th century, where along with scientific breakthroughs, you have political breakthroughs with regard to what the subject is capable of and how all subjects are capable of reason. It's a real breakthrough in terms of just the notion of equality, because under feudalism, that is not, there are just superior beings in the world, and then there are inferior beings, and the inferior beings are peasants, and their labor is manual, is to be exploited by the lords and ladies across most cultures. You know, this kind of exploitation is very raw, it's very immediate, and fortunately or unfortunately, this notion of equality and the capability of reason given to every human being really is an ideal that's born in the European 18th century. And all of those attempts to decolonize it, because it is also a period of time of colonial expansion, doesn't really get to the heart of this question, which is, what is democracy and how is it exercised politically outside of the realm of private life with regard to this new thing that Jürgen Habermas called the public sphere? And the public sphere is really distinguished from what comes before it in terms of a social space where people can argue with each other, can reason with each other. That social space under feudalism or the monarchy is called the court. And there's this brilliant book by Norbert Elias called The Court Society, which is very much about the European feudal court, where everything is meant to please the monarch. And so you have this way of self-presentation that is based on self-control and self-discipline. And it's, you know, the feudal aristocracy that have to sort of deal with this person who is superior to everyone, the king or the monarch, and this religious cadre of clergy, which rule the text, if you like, and the translation of the spiritual into governance. And when you govern under feudalism, it's a pyramidal shape. The king is given, you know, sort of directives from the divinity, and the courtiers help him rule. And I think the important thing about the bourgeois subject is it emerges at a time of the great revolutions, because if everyone is capable of reason, and we keep expanding that to women, to people who have been colonized by the Europeans, then the realm of liberal democracy is based upon this new space where people can argue and persuade each other of the correctness or the incorrectness of their views, of the views of others. Scientific accomplishments can be built upon each other because you present yourself using your capacity to replicate the scientific methodology with regard to other scientists. I mean, this is a period before, like in the 18th century, you have like these gentleman scholars or, you know, these, the owners of the means of production, right? Merchants and capitalists who are in the coffee houses of England, and they're exercising their ability to argue with each other to reach the best conclusions about, you know, what insurance of their boats or the rule of the land. And this was like actually a very new thing. And the notion of emotions was very restricted in this kind of bourgeois public sphere. On the other flip side of this, you have the rise of the bourgeois novel and the genre of melodrama, which is neither tragedy nor comedy, but a sphere in which great emotions are given, are replicated in narrative structures like the great English novels Pamela and Clarissa. You have these innocent victims and these pure servant girls who are being exploited by, you know, rapine masters. And you have a whole new level of literacy where young women and women are reading these novels and identifying with these women and their ability to have emotions. And the bourgeois subject then is forged on the one hand with the public sphere of reason, and on the other, on the gendered side, with female side, with this new idea that my emotions and the emotions of others can be shared and communicated and give us a kind of purity. It evolves into the 19th century Victorian, you know, angel of the house and everything else. And of course, it's very oppressive when women have to bear all the emotions and men are out there debating stuff in the public sphere. But this was truly revolutionary because the everyday life of the emotions was discounted almost universally across the board by a kind of martial, feudal, monarchical, oppressive ancient regime.
Right.
So you have, like, you know, maybe in the Greek epics or in these very hierarchical, you know, even slave-owning societies, like the people of leisure can have emotions and the aristocracy can have emotions. Those emotions are really important. And it's really in the bourgeois subject who says, my emotions are important. I'm not noble. I'm an everyday woman, but my feelings and my ability to identify my feelings and experience them and communicate them are giving me a new kind of sovereignty with regard to the social sphere.
So I think a lot of, I mean, on the contemporary left especially, people get a bit, give short shrift to this notion of the bourgeois subject. They're a bit sniffy about it often because it seems like an abstraction, often because it's a bit hoity-toity or it's overly rational and no place for emotions or inner life, it seems, which is very much the contrary. I mean, you've just been saying. I think we're going to double back to this, but maybe I'm just going to ask you this very basic question, which is, what is melodrama? I think people know what melodramatic means, but I don't know if people are, I don't have, a very clear idea of what melodrama is.
Okay. Well, melodrama is really a mode of drama that is a popularized and sort of lowbrow form of drama or tragedy, right? And it's really becomes like a new genre between tragedy and the novel in the 18th century when people are trying to figure out, like, what is the proper way to behave in an enlightened world. And when women are becoming more and more literate, they're not allowed to go to universities, but they have tutors, aristocratic bourgeois women have more leisure time, and people start writing novels for them and writing novels about them. And the great inventor of melodrama is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, actually, because a lot of his work is written, even his philosophy is written in the mode of melodrama. There are innocent victims. There are evil and nefarious forces, and the innocent victim has to go through a series of trials to prove his or her virtue, and impossible love and romance that falls outside of the institutional constraints of transactional marriage is the highest form of romance. So you have, like, forbidden love becoming like a very bourgeois thing, becoming adultery in Rousseau's case. But, you know, he was in love with this married woman, and, you know, he really writes about all of his feelings about her. And this exploration of feelings then translates into other novels, like I was saying, Pamela and Clarissa in the 18th century, where you have innocent servant girls and horrible lords and ladies who employed them. And in the case of Pamela, she's a victim, she's raped, she dies. In the case of Clarissa, she becomes more powerful and evil like her employers. But this idea of the innocent victim really comes from the bourgeois subject, the bourgeois subjectivity as was forged in the 18th century. And it was very entertaining for people to read these novels and to see these plays because they were less about lofty people who were distant from us, but, you know, like average, ordinary bourgeois people who were neither working class nor noble, but literate with extra leisure time to think about their feelings. And so you have this kind of like translation then into like vaudeville when you think of early cinema where you have like, or vaudeville plays where you're like, you know, I can't pay the rent. You must pay the rent. I can't pay the rent. I can't pay the rent. You must pay the rent. And then you have the hero come in. I'll pay the rent. And so innocent victim, usually a woman rescued by, you know, the male savior or whatever, and these evil oppressive forces. It's also a way for people to figure out how, especially women, to deal with the marketplace, right? You have suddenly this idea that bourgeois people are choosing to marry people they love. But of course, all marriage is all about calculation, as Jane Austen shows us. And so then where is the proper place for feeling when you have this kind of new idea that you can choose your spouse, right? This was not in feudal societies, and still in places like China and India, you kind of can choose your spouse, but not really. But this idea of the bourgeois subject is that I am in charge of my genitals. It's not for my, I'm not serving my family. I'm going to look for genital satisfaction with a person that I want to choose. And so how does that love blossom? What is that love about when so much of marriage had been part of chattel slavery, transactional alliances? You know, the brutality of pre-bourgeois marriage was all about, you know, disposing of feelings, working for sort of exogamous alliance and bringing property into your family or taking property into someone else's family. And suddenly you have all these dramas and all these stories about like who I love, who I shouldn't love, who I'm in love with, who I can love. And that's another part of the melodramatic world that then becomes, you know, in sort of, everyone looks down on it because it's a women's genre too. Rousseau was maybe one of its primary authors, but it really becomes a space of like female identification. And then when you have in Hollywood, the great melodramas of the 1930s and 40s are all about mothers and sacrifice. They are incredible films. Many of them very, very critical of the social system, like Douglas Sirk's films of the 1950s, but it's really about like exploring family life. The sphere of action in melodrama is all about the family, right? And about how I feel about my family and how I feel about my lover. Now, no one on the left.
Sorry. So these are all, like, it's all in the private, it's all in the private sphere, effectively. It's within the home. But are these the victims and villains? Are they representative of social values or social ideas or forces?
So, you know, you could say like the mean landlord or the, you know, guy that your boss wants to rape you because you're so attractive and you're this little servant girl. They represent some kind of like property power, male power, patriarchal power. Most melodrama is not considered very progressive because the social forces are really evil and many of the women die, they're victimized, and we sort of worship them, or else the resolution is found also in emotionality. Like, I accept my sacrifice. Stella Dallas, one of the great maternal melodramas of 1930s, is about, every time I watch it, I cry. And that's about the melodramatic narrative is about making you cry. Stella Dallas is a working class gal, very unclassy, played by Barbara Stanwyck, marries a rich guy who falls in love with her. They have a daughter, but he divorces her because she's too unclassy, too working class, and her daughter's like beautiful and sort of virtuous, and she decides to be adopted by the stepmother and the rich father. And they don't even invite Stella to the wedding. She looks at the wedding outside, the society wedding like everyone else, and she cries because this is her sacrifice to her daughter's future. So there's no question about like class society, is that right or wrong? You know, why does she have to make the sacrifice? Why is she so looked down upon because she's working class and vulgar? It's all about this incredibly beautiful act of sacrifice that she performs, and all of those feelings that it evokes in the audience and the way that Stanwyck plays about it. It's all about class, and it's all about this tragic woman, and the protagonist is often a woman. So it's a really important way in which popular culture and the movies found a female audience.
Okay. So, I mean, I guess that to a certain extent brings women into the public sphere or represents them publicly. What would be contemporary examples of melodrama? I mean, staying within the realm of, you know, of fiction, I guess.
A lot of melodramas played out in like the popularity of global soaps, Turkish soap operas, the Korean, South Korean soap operas. I don't watch them because I don't have enough time, but I'm sure I could get totally absorbed by them. Even like the prestige TV, like HBO, Netflix streaming stories, a lot of them have melodramatic elements. You know, the close-up of the woman. Recently, I'm watching Three Body Problem, and the only way that the adaptation can try to tell this very abstract science fiction story is actually also having like individualized feelings. So when you have these close-ups of like scientists having feelings, and the feelings are very important, they're melodramatic moments.
Right. Kind of one of the premises of this series, I guess, is that there is more the role that emotion has an increasing role in contemporary capitalism and the management of emotions, the publicness of emotions, the demonstration of, you know, crying, for example, in public and things like that. But at the same time, you know, if the bourgeois subject is something that is meant to be eroded, dying, perhaps dead, then how do we square that?
That's a really good question. So this whole idea of like the fullness of bourgeois life that's evolved from 18th to 19th centuries is that, you know, I am, as a bourgeois subject, I am aware of my emotions as a woman. I feel for others. You know, I am part of a world where the emotions become like intersubjective milestones or guideposts, and I read, I play music, I have, you know, romantic literature, romantic music makes me feel all these things. These are fantastic, and now we have this sense of emotional capacity. I think in the 21st century is more and more narrow, and that band of like widening emotions and sort of anti-patriarchal or anti-rational emotions that would give us a wider sphere of emotions, where listening to music or listening to you talk gives me a wide, extensive, you know, complex, nuanced set of emotions, is more and more narrow because of this ideology that's really, you know, comes from America. We talked about this with the wellness myth, that this kind of hyper subjectivization also narrows the band of accepted emotions, because we're all about creating this metastatic like level of non anxiety. So any anxiety that veers off the sort of metastatic norm is something that I have need to control. So if you make me uncomfortable, I'm like, Alex, I feel uncomfortable, and I need to go back to metastatic zero. I'm very, very aware of my emotions because I'm like a hyper-subjective bourgeois, you know, post-bourgeois person, but anything that makes me uncomfortable is identified as aberrational and needs to be controlled. Whether by yoga, deep breathing, drugs, anxiety, which is crippling and can be crippling, is this new form of of emotionality that's been pathologized. And so there's a much more pathological attitude towards like self-surveillance, especially among young people. I hate to say this, but so we've moved away from either the rational, I have no emotions, sort of subjective political reason, and the melodramatic, I'm all emotions, and that gives me a kind of authenticity, to this kind of highly like metastatic, controlled, terrified, phobic, emotional there's a kind of phobia about emotions that leaves like a very narrow band of acceptable emotionality, especially in social situations. And so with that metastatic band, like the only thing that seems to move this kind of metastatic norm is outrage or anxiety.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because I was thinking of an example, and also prompted by something that you had suggested that I read, which was Eva Illouz's book on Oprah Winfrey. I'm familiar with Illouz's work, but I hadn't read that one. And, you know, that makes the point about the role of kind of crying, the role of kind of the performance of suffering on that show and the way that Oprah mobilized that and created this kind of whole fiction around that. That was a narrative that was put forward by her show consistently. And she's an important enough figure, at least in American life, that it's worth, you know, really dwelling on that. So it would seem that emotionalism is, you know, greater than ever, right? It's very present because people are crying on TV in a way they didn't. They're opening up, right? Like you're encouraged to open up all the time, you know, even at work in places which were previously places which you try to clamp things down. So I think I'm trying to probe at something which might seem like a contradiction, which is like between what you've been describing, which I think is identifiable, right? Particularly this kind of Gen Z affect of you know, kind of like mumbled rap and all everything being a little bit kind of somehow, yeah, anxious and muted in color, you know, like emotionally painting with a more limited palette, if you want to put it that way, right? It's all kind of grays and whatnot. And then at the same time, this kind of display of like suffering and emotionalism on TV. And how do you square those two things?
The television culture that Winfrey pioneered really has this like very amazing media history, right? She sort of displaces Phil Donahue in the 1980s at a time when Reagan and Thatcher are coming into power in the Anglo-American world. And you have these like, you have a return of conservatism on the one hand, and then you have Winfrey, who's still preaching the pull yourself up by your bootstraps ethos, but she is expanding an audience of women, daytime television watchers, who can experience all these emotions together. And one of the things that Illouz says about Winfrey's, you know, sort of mediatic power is that she brings this kind of like Protestant prophecy, the preacher's emotionality to television itself. And that is, you know, seen by elites, I mean, you know, by educated credentialed professionals, and as that's denigrated, but it's got like hundreds of millions of people who are affected by it at the same time. And I would say, like, in a way, Gen Z is maybe the children of mothers who've been watching this stuff. They're the next generation, and so they've accepted this kind of highly reified public emotionality that was part of like late 20th century television in the Anglo-American world. And a lot of it, Illouz points out too, is carnivalesque stagings of like really excessive scenes. It's got freak show aspects to it. It treats the working class as spectacle. And Winfrey becomes herself, as she becomes more and more successful, more and more highbrow, more and more appealing to professional people. But I think that the children who have been part of this world or who grew up in these households, emotionality is no longer taboo. It's actually intersubjectivity that is so difficult and social life that is so difficult. So the mutedness, I think, and what we're talking about with the new generation is, and the generation we've done social media, is a lot of what they want from social interaction is just affirmation. Like, yeah, I know how that feels. And even like therapists asking, this is a whole other story, like, how does that make you feel? That's not a fucking therapeutic statement to say, actually, in the psychoanalytic terms, right? You're supposed to just be like, let the subject free associate. But in Anglo-American, like, you know, middle brow therapy, people are always like, you're like, yeah, my father marched out of my room and slammed the door. And you should pause and say, and let that person, you know, come up with their next association. But this kind of like the therapeutic goes, and how does that make you feel?
Yeah, yeah. No, what does that symbolize for you, for example?
Do you need to ask me how that made me feel? Like, there's no lacunae that cannot be filled with feeling.
Right. And it seems like something which is in search of connection, of connectivity. Right. And I think like a lot of the public crying as well, I think, is also in pursuit of some connection.
Yeah. The public crying. Yes.
Hi there, friends. This is the end of a sample from an episode available only to subscribers at patreon.com/bungacast. For $7 a month, subscribers get at least 4 original exclusive episodes a month, featuring Alex, George, and Phil, as well as our regular contributors, Alex Gurevich, Amberly Frost, Catherine New, and Lee Phillips. We've got episodes on current affairs, extended interviews, exclusive episodes on theory, history, culture, docuseries, analyses of film, and our responses to listeners' questions and criticisms. And for $12 a month, you also get access to the very special BungaCast Reading Club, where we present the key books and essays necessary for understanding the world today, how we got here, and where we might be going. Of course, if you just want to try us out, there's also a $3 entry tier giving you one exclusive episode a month. We do hope you'll join us. These are turbulent times, and ideologically confused ones as well. We try to find some political clarity so that we might move beyond the age of bunga bunga.